welcome to this week's episode of Military History Inside Out. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Diane North, who wrote, who's written California at War. It's about California during World War I, during the European period, and also up through to when the U.S. Entered and actually a few years beyond. So we discuss the California home front, how it was affected by the war, federal military bases that were built, the industries, how the industries were affected, how California instituted some kind of draconian anti-civil rights measures to sort of spy on people who were considered troublesome or dangerous for the country prior to the war. We talk about the Hollywood film industry, a lot of the contributions of the men and women who fought and served in the war before the U.S. joined, and then after the U.S. joined, we talk about scientific achievements and other issues. So definitely a very interesting talk in regards to how large groups deal with war from the home front, and just generally U.S. and California history in general, and obviously World War I history. So thank you for listening and enjoy. I'm speaking with Dr. Diane North, author of California at War, The State and the People During World War I. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about how you got into studying history and in writing about history.
Well, I was born and reared in Washington, D.C., and I was enthralled from a very early age with history. My father was a Naval Academy graduate, and he was always giving us history lessons and civic lessons, and we spent a good deal of time touring all the monuments, and I would, after I'd finished my tours, I could go downtown in the summers and sit in the House and the Senate and listen to debates. So I was a history major in college and gradually got a PhD in history. And I became interested in this topic because I noticed whenever the nation goes to war, it loses some of its precious civil liberties and enacts somewhat mean-spirited immigration legislation. I became interested in California at War because the centennial for World War I was approaching when I began my research, and I wanted to know several major questions. What happened to the people and the nation when the nation goes to war, and to bring that down to a more controllable element, I looked at California because it's one of the world's major economies now. It's a trendsetter. It's the state with the largest population today. And I wanted to know what happened in its early 20th century history, and no one had written about this topic. I wanted to look at the total picture, the political, the economic, the military, the legal, the social, and the public health aspects of a wartime environment. And California lent itself because it would be a challenge to discover all the primary resources. The other main question that I asked was, how did the United States become a national security state? What was the journey that brought us to where we are today? And that question arose because shortly after 9/11, the character of Washington, D.C. changed radically. There were policemen everywhere in marked and unmarked cars. There were security cameras. there were barriers where there used to be open access. You could no longer sit on the Capitol steps and watch the sunset or ride your bike through the Capitol Gardens. It changed. Mm-hmm. And the Patriot Act is one good example of what happened after 9/11. So there are other questions I started thinking about, and those were, what reasons are there to go to war? What are the country's goals? Is there a plan to end the war? How long does the nation intend to remain at war? What types of weapons does it plan to use?
Mm-hmm.
What will it cost in human and economic terms? Who benefits economically? And how will civil liberties be protected? Those questions grew out of what I learned from writing California War.
So, was World War One a topic you were interested in since you were young, you know, along with the rest of history, or did it grow up, arise later?
Well, when I was growing up, I can remember distinctly seeing the rather unkempt World War One memorial downtown.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And it's a small memorial, and no one ever visits it. But I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was another thing that caught my eye, which was, in our neighborhood, there was a man, well-dressed, and every afternoon he would take a walk, and he always looked so sad. And as a little girl, I asked my dad what was the matter with this man. And he said, well, he was very sad, and he explained why. He had been one of the crew members on the Enola Gay that bombed Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Dad had to explain about World War II and Japanese American incarceration. And that got me thinking, what would make a nation do that? Where does it all stem? And then he explained to me a little bit about California history. So this has been in the back of my mind for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach for the University of Maryland University College. And a number of years ago, it gave me the opportunity to create a new course, a new worldwide course, on World War One, complete with making 8 films. And that gave me the opportunity to sink my teeth into the literature from around the world. I mean, this war was fought not only in Europe, but in the Middle East, and Africa, and Asia, and at sea. And so I've had a chance to learn about that, but I'm also a specialist in the American West, and have written about the American West in the past, and indeed lived in California for a while, and taught California history. So it all came together. It just all worked.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, you already mentioned that some of the topics you touch on in the book. Can you expand more on the subject matter and focus of the book?
Yes. The book, there's a prologue, there's an introduction that takes a look at California before the United States enters the war, and it sets the scene. Starts out, actually, with a bombing, the preparedness, the 1916 Preparedness Day bombing in San Francisco. Here, there were 50,000 people taking part in a parade, and all of a sudden, a bomb explodes, and at least 40 are injured, 10 are killed, and that sets the scene for the way in which Californians thought about the war. There were many who wanted the United States to be prepared for the war, but there were others who opposed that idea vehemently, or they did it in peaceful means. So that introduction describes that. Chapter 1 talks about the men who served overseas either before the United States declared war or after the United States declared war. So I take a look at individuals who signed up with the British Royal Artillery Service or with the French and served with the Lafayette Escadrille or with the French foreign forces, foreign legion, and also the young men from University of California, Berkeley, and Stanford University who served as ambulance drivers for the French in France or with its French allies in the Balkans. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of that chapter takes a look at the Navy, the American Expeditionary Forces, the Army and Marines, for example, the U.S. Army Air Service pilots, and their experiences fighting primarily in Europe, but also a large contingent of California men served in Siberia. They left California in the late summer of 1918 and did not return, some of them, until 1920.
Mm-hmm.
Then chapter 2 does the same thing, but we look at the women. The women who served overseas, they did humanitarian work. For example, Julie Helen Heinemann was an artist, and she was a San Francisco artist, and she was living in London. And when the Belgian soldiers had to retreat as the Germans advanced, they fled to London, and she noticed there was no one taking care of. So she established a California house for disabled Belgian soldiers and trained them in rehabilitated, trained them in craft skills and mathematics and languages. And then the British noticed what she was doing, and they asked her to set up 3 Kitchener houses in cooperation with the British Red Cross. So I look at a number of women. Ethel Sperry Crocker, who used her own money to rebuild a destroyed French village, or women who served with the American Red Cross in France as doctors and as nurses. There's one woman, Bessie Beatty, who was a correspondent at the San Francisco Chronicle, and she was in Russia during the height of the revolution, and her experiences are invaluable. Chapter 3 takes a look at the rise of the military in California.
Mm-hmm.
I go throughout the state and I examine how the Army and the Navy spent considerable money building camps, bases, airfields, hospitals, training centers, training stations, expanding the Mare Island Naval Yard. Chapter 4 looks at the economy of war.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's so fascinating is that war accelerated the process of corporate organization and witnessed a dramatic rise in industrial employment. Between 1914 and 1919, 11 industries experienced more than 150% growth in employment, and the 2 biggest ones were shipbuilding and in petroleum extraction.
Mm-hmm.
Then I take a look at the home front, the kinds of things that men and women were doing on the home front to raise money for the American Red Cross and every other war-related activity. And I try to look at all of the how African Americans and Asian Americans and Native Americans participated in this home front volunteer effort.
Mm-hmm.
The next chapter answers the question about public health, because I talk about the 1918-1920 influenza pandemic and how California citizens and politicians and the military responded to the crisis. So part of the chapter deals with how the military dealt with it and the other, how the civilians dealt with it. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles had the best record of preventing deaths in the country. San Francisco was not that stellar. And in many instances, the military stepped forward to help civilians because they were overwhelmed and could not cope. Then chapters 7 and 8 look at those questions that have to do with civil liberties restrictions and the rise of the national security state.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happened with California's participation in World War I is that the war served as a powerful catalyst for the making of modern California because it expanded the role of government and enlarged the presence of private citizens associations. Hyper-patriotic private citizen associations played a significant role, and Chapter 7 looks at the California branch of the American Protective League, that quasi-governmental agency that was recognized by the Department of Justice as the premier and eventually only Department of Justice recognized private citizens patriotic association that could spy on citizens without government oversight. So Chapter 7 goes into great detail, going from Eureka to San Diego, to see how the various chapters of these white, largely Christian males went about entering people's homes when they weren't there, reading their mail, writing reports about their activities. If they were eating too much white bread, they complained about it. It's quite telling. Chapter 8 looks at what the state did. For example, the California Council of Defense created a statewide apparatus that did a number of very positive things. It promoted scientific research. It promoted agricultural development. But it also created county committees of loyalty, where just as the American Protective League, men were doing, these committees of loyalty spied, the members spied on other citizens. And the reports that I read were simply fascinating. For example, one farmer writes in that his neighbor across the street is not planting enough of wheat, and wheat will help win the war, and you need to investigate this. Well, other things happened. One of the most unsettling was that the University of California required that its students, faculty, and staff sign a oath of loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
This is decades before the controversial 1950s Cold War oath of loyalty.
Right.
In addition, the State Department of Education decided that German language and literature could no longer be studied because the 19th century culture of Germany was worthwhile, but the early 20th century Kultur, K-U-L-T-U-R, was harmful for young minds. And so they prohibited the teaching of German language and literature in the schools, and churches even would not allow German hymns to be sung. This was not unusual. That happened in other places, but very few states demanded loyalty oaths. Then the Commission of Immigration and Housing decided to see if it could take the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a whose rhetoric was worse than its deeds, and it got blamed for a lot of different things. But they came up with a scheme, and this will sound familiar, they came up with a scheme to, one, silence them, so try to silence the press so that the press couldn't write about them, two, incarcerate them so that they wouldn't get into trouble. They were not successful in doing either of those two things, but they tried. And then, at the end of the war, the California legislature, even though it had been trying to do it for a while, finally passed a Criminal Syndicalism Act that restricted First Amendment rights of free speech, press, association, and assembly. So to sum it up, the things that I learned from writing California War were what I mentioned earlier, the war's California's participation in the war served as a powerful catalyst for the making of modern California, because it expanded the role of government and enlarged the presence of private citizens associations. Point two, never before had so many Californians, especially women, taken such a dynamic part in community, state, national, and international affairs. And as I mentioned earlier, the war accelerated the process of corporate organization and witnessed a dramatic rise in industrial employment. I alluded to this, but I didn't explain it completely, which would be, I guess, point four. With the support of elected officials, entrepreneurs, and California scientists, World War I generated military-based revenues for California and laid the groundwork for the state's post-war military expansion, because the Navy decided to split the fleet at the end of the war and positioned the Pacific Fleet in San Diego, and that made a significant difference. And then five, the imposition of civil liberties restrictions seriously damaged First Amendment rights in California for the rest of the century. And I won't go into that now, but there were a series of court cases, and even though in the 1960s the Supreme Court throughout California's criminal syndicalism law, the state passed variations of it until the 1990s.
So, in this period, what would you say is the ratio between the federal government pushing the changes that occurred in California versus state and local governments pushing the changes or initiatives?
Well, it was Congress that declared war, and one of California's senators was a pacifist, Senator John Downey Works, and he was appalled. But what I noticed in California is that as the government instituted measures, Californians rose to meet that and began to enact similar measures. Berkeley instituted an anti-free speech ordinance, for example, and that was repeated in other cities. The American Protective League grew in California to such an extent that its experiences are, I guess one would say, the most notable or worst in the nation. California's industrial development Once the war started, when the war started in 1914, the United States actually was in a recession, and there was a debate whether U.S. financiers and manufacturers should be allowed to participate in the war. Well, they quickly realized they'd have a splendid opportunity here, and by 1915, the California economy was booming because it's agriculture, feeding the troops, manufacturing was expanding. So even before the United States entered the war, there was a real war presence in California because its economy benefited significantly from the war.
From trading with the European.
But then, Californians want some of that European trade as German U-boat traffic and the British blockade came into effect. California had an advantage. It increased its Pacific trade considerably.
Interesting. So, before the war, was California that... Did it follow the federal government's lead that enthusiastically in just other everyday sort of things?
I think there was a strong peace movement in California that quickly got squashed when Wilson created the Committee of Public Information and Congress began passing Espionage and Sedition Acts, and the Post Office Department, for example, began curtailing free speech and free press. What I noticed was that there were, prior to the war, a significant number of foreign language presses. But by the end of the war, those had decreased considerably because of the restrictions placed upon them by the U.S. Post Office Department. Californians saw that the war effort brought money into their communities, and that laid the foundation, I believe, for the growth of the military welfare state in California. They got practice. Businessmen, politicians, and working with the military to create new military facilities. And you'll see in California at War, not only is there a whole chapter devoted to the details of where all of those facilities were built and how much money was spent, but there's also a good map that shows you that expansion also.
So what resources did you use to do your research?
Well, that was a lot of fun. First, I started on the federal side in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And what I needed to do, so I used the National Archives in downtown Washington, in Maryland, and in California. And I went through the records of the Departments of War, including the Military Intelligence Division, Justice, specifically the Bureau of Investigation and the American Protective League, Post Office, Labor, the Council of National Defense, the War Labor Policy Board, the Provost Marshal General, Immigration and Naturalization Service, and that was headed by a Californian. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Food and Fuel Administration, and the Food Administration was headed by Herbert Hoover, who was a Californian, and the Fuel Administration in California was headed by a Californian. The Alien Property Custodian, the U.S. Shipping Board, the American Expeditionary Files, and the photographs taken by the U.S. Army Signal Corps. And then I went to the Library of Congress, and they were wonderful because I looked through reel after reel after reel of propaganda and feature films produced during the war. By the time the war started, the California film industry, which was just sort of getting started, was having a downturn. But the war, since Hoover declared the war essential, declared the film industry essential to the war effort, this helped Hollywood considerably. So I sat in the Library of Congress and watched all these propaganda films and feature films. In addition, the Library of Congress housed all the printed records of the Army and the Navy, including medical records and expenditures for military expansion on the home front, and census data and legislation and economic reports and state and federal court cases, and of course, countless pictures of people and places. And the U.S. Naval History and Heritage Command at the Washington Navy Yard, I think I became enamored of this huge tome put out by the Bureau of Yards and Docks, which has pictures of all of the cranes and shipbuilding apparatus. Quite fascinating. So I spent a lot of time at the Navy Yard. In California, I started with the State Archives in Sacramento, and I studied the records at the Public Utilities Commission because I was interested in petroleum, the Commission of Immigration and Housing because I was interested in labor, the Adjutant General because of the military, the State Council of Defense, the Attorney General, and something called a War History Committee. But I also found wonderful material at the Hoover Institution Archives in Stanford because it had been collecting World War I material for decades and decades. And there I came across the journals and diaries of men and women who served overseas. That was invaluable. And then I also used the Bancroft Library at Berkeley. But I did something that my friends couldn't believe, but I started in Eureka, and I went all the way down to San Diego, and I went to individual county clerks' offices. For example, state passed the Criminal Syndicalism Act, but then county commissioners of Eureka did the same thing. Oh, well, of Humboldt County did the same thing. And so I went throughout the state looking at historical societies and museum archives. For example, I can remember I had hit a treasure trove in the Santa Barbara Historical Museum because a woman who headed a branch of the California Food Administration, her autobiography was in Santa Barbara. So I just kept digging. And one of the last things I did is I wanted to see the work of official American Expeditionary Force war artists. Was one, Captain Ernest Peshuda, who was a Californian, and he served in the Engineer Reserve Corps, 42nd Division. And he not only created a remarkable visual record, but he also wrote about his experiences in France and with the U.S. Army of Occupation along the Rhine. And we tend to forget that some Americans didn't come home until 1921 or 22, because the U.S. forces were occupying the Rhine along with the Brits and the French. So that's how I did my research. Yes, it took a long time.
So when you looked at the movies, I'm curious, the movies that were produced before war was declared, what was the mix of isolationism versus sort of interest in joining the war? You know, how did it fall out?
Well, actually, you had both. But curiously, you had some odd things. For example, I don't know if you know this, but Californians, since Gold Rush, has a anti-Asian characteristic. And they they were the citizens who pressed the government to push to pass the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 19th century, and California passed anti-Japanese acts in the 20th century, and Californians pressed Congress after the war to exclude more Japanese. There were films suggesting that the Japanese were the enemy and might come along the California coast and bomb the coast in their ships, or there are feature films with this idea in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you understand the context of Californians' racial history, mm-hmm. you see that this was not unusual. But there were many films that we would call pacifists and many films that promoted the war. But when the U.S. declared war, the films focused on serving your country, being a man and serving your country.
Mm-hmm. So I guess most of these films were expected to be distributed nationally, or were there some that were just made for Californians?
Oh, no. The films that were created in Hollywood were distributed not only nationally, but the Committee of Public Information that President Woodrow Wilson created by executive order had an international film bureau. These films were shown abroad.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So, of the many documents and objects that you came across, were there any that really stood out as most fascinating or interesting?
Yes. There was a pilot, a United States Army Air Service pilot, by the name of Sidney Coe Howard. Howard was a University of California graduate, and he served first with the American Field Ambulance Service in France and then in the Balkans. And then he enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Service and became a fighter pilot. Sidney Coe Howard was a superb writer. He went on in the 20s to win a Pulitzer for one of his plays, and he won an Oscar for his screenplay of Gone with the Wind. Mm. His letters are thrilling. He describes a multiplane dogfight over French-German territory that is so vivid and chilling that you felt you were there, and I was able to put it in the book. So that was a great find. And the other thing is that I found some of his work at the Bancroft, but he wrote to a woman who also was a war correspondent, and her letters are at Yale. So the bulk of his correspondence is at Yale. Then at the Hoover Institution Archives in Stanford, California, are just superb. And I found a collection of photographs that shipyards in California and they were splendid, and no one had seen these pictures, and that was just great. And then I also unearthed a journal of a Stanford ambulance driver who became a pilot, and this young man, Joseph Eastman, kept a beautiful journal and did magnificent drawings of what was happening at the time. And it was very soul-searching. It was asking what's happening, how's he going to be after the war, what's going to happen to his generation after the war. Insightful material.
So that makes me want to ask, the artist, the pilot artist you had previously mentioned, I guess his work isn't publicly available or able to be publicly seen.
No, no. In fact, what I'd like to do is ask the Hoover if it would be possible for me to edit that journal and then get it published. So that's one of my next jobs.
Yeah, that would be fascinating to see. That would be
right,
awesome.
It would be. So I'll ask them and see if they'll agree.
What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
What I found that was most, well, there's two parts to that question. I was appalled by the civil liberties restrictions that Californians heaped upon its citizens when the federal government was already doing a terrible job of that.
Mm-hmm.
That appalled me. And the cavalier way they thought that this war was going to be the war to end all wars when the United States had not even been attacked.
Mm-hmm.
That, I found, was stunning. The second thing was how brave and courageous and smart and adventuresome the women were. When you read the history of World War I in the United States, it focused on East Coast women. Not a thing is said about California or California women, but they did a lot of good, and it was fun to track them down and find out who they were and what they did, and they kept good diaries and wrote fine letters, and so you could piece the puzzle together.
What would you say was the most difficult thing to research? Perhaps something you still don't have an answer for, or something that just took a long time to figure out?
I would think the most difficult aspect was the economic chapter. It's very detailed. There are a number of tables that discuss industrial employment and wages. And so most historians aren't trained in economics. I tend to think it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So it required a lot of primary research in material of the period to understand wages and prices and employment statistics and cost of living increases and these kinds of things.
So, ratio-wise, how would you break down the California economy between, say, agriculture, manufacturing, and maybe service or something else that I haven't mentioned?
That's a good question. I'd have to think about that a minute. I think the key increases at the time, there was a 1,300% rise in employment in shipbuilding. And then there was 470% rise in employment in the production of chemicals. And then after that, there were significant agricultural changes in growth in the industry, in the canning and preserving of fish, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And but in addition to steel shipbuilding, wooden ship and boat building increased significantly, as did iron and steel production, the creation of engines and steam and gas and water apparatus for building engines. And then, as I mentioned earlier, petroleum refining saw a significant increase in wage earners, in employment.
What were the, can you name the main science labs in California at the time?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the two major universities were the University of California and Stanford University. And when the United States entered the war, the scientists at Berkeley and at Cal got together And with the support of the Council of Defense, created a committee on scientific resources. No other state in the nation did this. And what the Committee on Scientific Resources did is that it conducted research in support of the war. Some of it was confidential, but it also did research to increase the economic potential of the state. And so they had scientists and engineers and physicians and economists, and they looked at all kinds of things. They found a better way. They found a better way to build a gas mask, for example.
Mm-hmm.
One woman, I love her name, Georgina Breckenridge Spooner, did the key research on botulism. Because remember, everything was shipped overseas in tin cans,
mm-hmm.
and they were concerned about botulism poisoning. And so she did significant work on that. And then there was research done to how to protect crops, from pests, and how to store grain and seeds and dried fruits more effectively. There were some committees that did geological and mineral research for the state to promote gold and silver mining, and there was a committee on engineering and invention that studied the use of hydrogen detectors in submarines and balloons, the absorption of hydrogen in submarines, the use of fire extinguishers in confined spaces aboard ships, and manufacturing processes for airplane construction. So they did a number of fascinating studies. And at the end of the war, the California Committee on Science Research made a report to the National Research Council, the working arm of the National Academy of Sciences. And it published for nationwide distribution the California report and said, look what the state did. All the rest of you should be doing things like this. So this was the thing that I found that was so much fun. That they tried to find better wire cutters for the barbed wire along no man's land.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the most significant things they did was they found a better way to. They found a way to improve gas masks, since poison gas was used.
Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a different topic, but I know that the war was sort of accused or considered one of the reasons the temperance movement really resulted in prohibition being passed. How was California involved in that?
Well, California produces a lot of grain, and you make alcohol from grain.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a strong temperance movement, and it used the war to promote itself. And indeed, the federal government passed laws prohibiting the sale or distribution of alcohol near military facilities. And so these American Protective League spies that I mentioned earlier would make certain that the soldiers and sailors were protected.
Protected from alcohol.
Yes, right. There was a strong also anti-vice movement, but that's another topic. Mm. But, yeah, so, well, so yes, to answer your question, yes.
So I know many states had prohibition already in place before the federal amendment was passed. Was California one of those?
Well, the California Food Administration restricted the distribution of food substances that went into alcohol. So that was one way that it was done. There was an extraordinarily active California Food Administration that mimicked what the federal government was doing.
It's really interesting to consider how, you know, it's the other side of the country, and yet California seemed so tied into the federal government.
It made itself. I think it didn't want to be left out. Here we are. We are doing these things, and we are going to take the lead in some of these things. And our economy is going to grow. All aspects of the economy grow. The Pacific shipping exports were phenomenal at the time. And it took advantage. Californians were smart enough to take advantage of every aspect of the war to promote growth within the state.
So it sounds like it was primarily, it was economically driven. You know, the money is what people really looked forward to having, you know, to take advantage of this, it sounds like.
Well, I didn't conclude that. In other words, I think it was a strong, you ask, what did they have to gain or lose?
Right.
That was one of the things I asked. But these people were strongly patriotic. They believed President Wilson when he said this will be the war to end all wars, which was not original with Wilson, by the way. That idea arose prior to the outbreak of World War I, and it was a strange blend of idealism and I don't know what. The notion that this next war will end all wars. Now, for example, prior to the outbreak of the war, H.G. Wells, the British author and science fiction writer, wrote a series of essays for a local London paper. And by the time the war broke out, those were published in a book. And he promulgated this idea that a good war will end all wars. And so it wasn't a new idea with Wilson. But Americans bought this idea, believed Wilson when he said that he wanted to save democracy. And of course, we had an exceptionally racist society, and he had segregated portions of the federal government that had already been of the civil service that had already been desegregated. But patriotism was a strong rallying cry for these people. And then once their men and women went overseas, it became personal. Because their husbands and sons and brothers and uncles and aunts and sisters serving overseas or in Siberia. California women also went as nurses and American Red Cross aides to Siberia when Woodrow Wilson decided that the United States was going to see if it could influence the Russian Revolution.
Interesting. So what do you hope the book will do?
I hope it will encourage people to ask the question I asked earlier. What reasons are there to go to war? What are the country's goals? Is there a plan to end it? How long does the nation intend to remain at war? What types of weapons does it plan to use? What will it cost in human and economic terms? Who benefits economically, and how will civil liberties be protected? That's what I hope people will think about. What happens to a people when a nation goes to war?
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published?
No, I just really really fortunate. I sent it to the editor at the University of Kansas Press because I have a deep respect for the press's work. It produces fine books on war, history, society, and law.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big book that covers all of those aspects and more. And I sent it off, and within a week they said, "Who published it?" I was just flabbergasted.
Nice. So where can people find this book and your other work?
Well, the California War is available from the University Press of Kansas, and indeed all university presses have a summer sale, so you can buy it 30% off in the month of July. You can purchase it on Amazon, and it's also available from Target. All the Target stores will be carrying, and Target online. The University Press, the book is only $29.95. It's 496 pages. It has 67 illustrations, two maps, two appendices, 14 tables. And the University Press and Target made an arrangement, and Target is selling the book for only $20 if you buy it online, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three, and you can buy from your independent bookseller. Just ask for Diane North, California at War.
Do you have a webpage?
A webpage goes up next week.
Okay.
I will send it to you. Yes, a webpage goes up next week.
Okay. Any final thoughts? That's all the questions I have.
No, it's just it's been fun, and you're a great listener, and you ask good questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez Warscholar, on YouTube under warscholar1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.